Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. On the show today, analysis of the impact of Minnesota Senator Al Franken's decision to resign.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office.
Plus, a scathing state report finds that kids under the supervision of the Department of Children and Families suffered at least 260 serious injuries recently, and DCF didn't know.
If they don't know about them, then they can't act upon them.
Also today, fashion mogul Diane von Furstenberg on revolutionizing fashion and the workplace.
I took it for granted, and I accepted that being a woman, you got your period every month, and you got groped all the time.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Today, I am announcing that in the coming weeks, I will be resigning as a member of the United States Senate.
That is Minnesota Senator Democrat Al Franken today announcing his resignation following intense pressure from 32 other Senate Democrats who called for him to step down in response to accusations from at least six women who say he touched them inappropriately. Most of the alleged incidents took place before he was a senator. And Franken today said he denies many of their claims or remembers others differently. Now, Senate Democrats' drive to force Franken's resignation stands in stark contrast to how the Republican Party is rallying in support of Roy Moore, the Alabama Senate candidate who's accused of sexually pursuing teenaged girls when he was in his 30s. In his Senate speech today, Franken noted what he called the, quote, irony.
I, of all people, am aware that there is some irony in the fact that I am leaving while a man who has bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault sits in the Oval Office, and a man who has repeatedly preyed on young girls campaigns for the Senate with the full support of his party.
Senator Franken there with a not-so-veiled reference to President Donald Trump. White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked today about Franken's comment.
The president addressed the comments back during the campaign. We feel strongly that the people of this country also addressed that when they elected Donald Trump to be president. And I've addressed it several times from here and don't have anything new to add.
Let's talk about the significance of all this. Joining us is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. It's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So what's been the reaction to Franken's announcement today?
Well, as you mentioned, about over 30 Democratic senators have already called on him to resign. I think that the conclusion was just that his time is up. This was a difficult decision for Democrats because he has cultivated many close relationships with fellow Democrats here in the Senate over his, what is it now, I guess 8 years in the chamber. He barely won his election in 2008, and he won a pretty comfortable victory, double-digit victory in a bad year for Democrats in 2014. And, you know, he sort of left his mark on the institution with his colleagues, so I think a lot of them felt conflicted. But on the other hand, they did find his behavior highly inappropriate, inexcusable, and I think yesterday's accusation, the latest accuser came out, said that Senator Franken had forcibly kissed her years ago. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. So, it's a mixed feelings here among Democrats.
No, we should note that Franken said, as we heard in that tape, that he will be resigning in the coming weeks, meaning what, the end of this year? That would keep him in the Senate for some several potential key votes.
That's right. And it's important to note that seat is still safe for Democrats. It will be his successor will be appointed by Mark Dayton, the governor of Minnesota, who is a Democrat. So it won't change the partisan balance in the Senate. It'll remain a 52-48 narrow Republican majority. But in the next couple of weeks, there will be a lot of important votes happening, most notably the final conference report of the tax reform bill that Republicans want to pass. There will be probably multiple votes on government funding legislation to prevent a shutdown. There could be issues like the Children's Health Insurance Program coming up, measures to stabilize the Affordable Care Act insurance marketplaces, and possibly, though not likely, a Dreamer fix.
Now, Franken did mention that he felt that if there had been an ethics committee investigation, that he believes the committee would not have found that, would find that he did not, quote, dishonor the Senate. I mean, given that, though, I understand he was facing all this pressure from his fellow Senate Democrats, but why didn't he hold out for an investigation?
Well, that was a plan for a while, but that becomes untenable when, you know, most of your own party caucus is now calling on you to resign. Any senator, you know, needs those relationships to be effective. You have to have allies to work with on issues. You need co-sponsors for pieces of legislation. And when more than half of your own party's colleagues have deemed you unworthy of being in the Senate, I think he correctly realized that his future was pretty much over, and there was no point going through the whole, you know, going through the motions only to quit again.
So, Sahil, one last question regarding what Franken said about what he sees as the irony of him resigning when the Republican National Committee is rallying around Roy Moore in Alabama, and Senator Franken also noted, you know, controversy surrounding President Trump here. I just wonder, I mean, critics of Franken might say that Democrats are showing some significant moral backbone by pushing for his resignation, and also similarly in the House, the resignation of John Conyers. But on the other hand, you know, in terms of these other men that you know, have come under scrutiny, Roy Moore, et cetera, it's like night and day between how the parties are handling it. So will this make any difference whatsoever in terms of how Republicans handle accusations against their own members?
Well, it'll certainly put pressure on Republicans to deal more strongly with their own, you know, alleged abusers and harassers in their ranks. I think we are seeing the beginnings of a meaningful divergence between the two parties after Democrats had initially dithered on whether Franken should resign and whether John Conyers, a now former dean of the House, amid accusations against him, should resign. But Democrats have now pushed them both out. While Republicans are warming up to Roy Moore, the White House and the RNC is all in for Moore, despite the fact that he is alleged to have molested girls, underage girls, and had various other accusations from women who have come forward lately. So certainly that's Democrats, in their view, laying a claim to the moral high ground here, that they are, you know, they have decided to be the party that's not going to tolerate this. And certainly there are Democrats who have pointed this out. Senator Bernie Sanders, the runner-up for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2016, said maybe President Trump should follow Franken's lead and also consider resigning. The president has more than a dozen women coming forward and accusing him of sexual harassment or assault. Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democratic senator, also said hopefully he hopes the American people will take note of Republican support for, I'm quoting here, a morally degraded Senate candidate in Alabama and a president in the Oval Office saying equally credible charges, unquote, as all Franken. So Democrats are eager to highlight this.
Well, that's Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg Politics. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, let's turn now and get some reaction from a member of the Massachusetts delegation. Representative Stephen Lynch joins us. He represents the 8th. Congressman, it's good to have you back.
Good to speak with you, Magna.
So what's your reaction to Senator Franken's resignation? And also on the House side, we had John Conyers say he was going to step down.
I think the right thing to do in both those cases. I think that, you know, it was a little bit of time in coming, but I think they both arrived at the right decision.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I was thinking about the fact that your colleague, Congressman Seth Moulton, has said that, you know, perhaps responsibility should also go higher. He's called for House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi to step aside. Do you fault Democratic leaders in the House for any of this going on?
Well, I think there was an interview. I didn't see it, but I thought at one point there was an interview in which Leader Pelosi called John Conyers an icon, and I think tried to point to his previous record and longevity in the House as a way of protecting him. And I think, she was countermanded by Jackie Speier and some of the other women in Congress who pointed out that we could not demand, or control the moral high ground here if we were going to tolerate this type of behavior within our own party and within our own caucus here in Washington. And so Leader Pelosi did an about-face at that point and I think got right with the membership here. And, I think people have been fairly solid in their insistence that that Frank and Mr. Conyers both leave.
Yeah. Congressman, you wrote a letter to your constituents, and in it you wrote that, quote, over the last 2 months, we have learned about allegations of misconduct by powerful men in almost every industry, including Congress. This conduct is absolutely unacceptable, and it must have career-ending, life-altering consequences for the perpetrators. Then you wrote, the system for handling these allegations in Congress is arcane and does little, if anything, to support the brave victims who come forward. So how might you change the system in Congress to handle this?
The problem here is that there is an asymmetry in power, okay? So you've got members of Congress who have enormous power, staff, standing, influence here. And then you have, in many cases, at least in our institution, junior employees that have very little in way of employee protections. And so what I suggested and what I think should happen is that there needs to be an ombudsman-type position or an advocate position created where that person would have, the imprimatur of official status to bring the charges on behalf of someone who has been harassed or is having those type of problems with an employer, with a member of Congress, or with senior staff. Some of the staff here is very, very powerful as well, chiefs of staff, things like that. So I think we really have to get at that. And I don't really think that that any of the proposals that I've heard so far, there's been a proposal that I certainly support where employees and members of Congress have to go through the sexual harassment orientation and awareness training, things like that. And that's all fine. But I really think when something happens like this, you really need to have an advocate on your side that is able to prosecute the case and bring it forward. Sort of what we have at the state level with EEOC type claims, where there's an actual advocate who steps in for you and has much more influence and power than a low-level or entry-level employee might have.
Yeah. We're running out of time with you, Congressman, so can I just get one more question here about the actual business going on in the House? Because
sure.
I understand that that House there's supposed to be some kind of vote today to keep the government open until the 22nd of December. Is that right?
That's correct. That's a short-term continuing resolution. But we're having some real differences because the Republicans have refused to, acknowledge the need to resolve the children's health insurance program.
Yeah.
That's still not addressed. We have a number of outstanding issues there that they would like to fund the Defense Department without funding the domestic side of our agenda here. So that's not sitting well with a lot of members, including myself. So we've got some real differences. And right now, based on the deal that the Republicans have on the table, I would say the Democrats are nearly unanimously opposed to the CR. And I think because of the internal problems within the Republican Party, they need some Democratic votes. So right now we're holding the line, and we would like to see a CR that is more respectful of some of the issues that we've raised.
Yeah. Well, Congressman Stephen Lynch represents Massachusetts' 8th District. Congressman, it's always good to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna. Have a good day now.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Children under the care of the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families suffered at least 260 serious injuries between 2014 and 2015, and none of those injuries were noted in their DCF records. That deeply disturbing conclusion from a report out today by State Auditor Suzanne Bump. The report also found that social workers didn't know children they were monitoring had been badly hurt. And even more troubling, the report found 19 instances, including rape, sexual abuse by a DCF contracted employee, or assaults. But those cases were not reported to local prosecutors. Now, this report comes as DCF has been undergoing major reform efforts since September 2015 after several children died while under DCF supervision. Joining us now in the studio to discuss the report is State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here.
So first of all, tell us more about what you found. These sound like very serious failings on DCF's part.
They are. They are. We used the information at our disposal, the same information that DCF has at its disposal, but does not use, still does not use, and found that there were, as you said, 260 serious bodily injuries for which kids had been received medical treatment that the social workers' case files didn't know about. It wasn't contained in the files. DCF's response in the audit, which apparently is different from what they're telling the press today, is that, well, sometimes that medical information is old, and you know, it's already occurred. I can't understand for the life of me how they cannot appreciate that whether the information is 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months old, they need to be accessing this information so they have a complete picture of what's happening to the children in their care. How can they defend such willful ignorance?
Well, so let me ask you, because I'm just wondering, Mass Health provides records of all medical treatments to an enrolled member. And in its response to your report, DCF indicated that it hadn't taken action to implement some recommendations regarding getting those Mass Health records because they believe that the data in that Mass Health provided is not timely, as you were mentioning.
Right.
But is there any credence to that?
No. Frankly, we use the MassHealth data in our auditing of MassHealth and also in auditing agencies like this whose people who are served by that agency are enrolled in MassHealth. So we know that the information is very current. And as I say, even if the information is 2 days old or it's 2 weeks old, or it's 2 months old. This is still information that's relevant to the treatment of that child who's already in DCF custody. So I can't fathom their defense of willingly being ignorant, maintaining, you know, that they should be able to be ignorant of these cases.
So we asked DCF Commissioner Linda Spears for an interview, and they declined our request, but they did send us a statement. And in this statement, they said that the department's priority is to protect the most vulnerable children, and it relies on mandated reporters such as healthcare providers, physicians, and teachers to provide us with up-to-the-moment information. DCF regularly conducts trainings for mandated reporters across the state, offers online training, et cetera, et cetera. And so it seems they seem to be saying that perhaps the gap is in the mandated reporters not providing timely information to DCF.
That is indeed a phenomenon. It doesn't relieve DCF, however, of using the information to which it has ready access in order to track what's going on with the children in their care.
Okay. So about the 19 then specific cases that your report found where there was sexual abuse by a DCF contracted employee, assaults, rape. I mean, terrible things happening to children in these specific 19 cases in your report, and those cases not having been reported to local prosecutors. Mary Lou Sutters, the Secretary for Health and Human Services for the Commonwealth, is actually right now at this moment giving a conference call to reporters. And she's saying that in those 19 cases that were apparently not referred to DAs, she says they were all referred to law enforcement. Sometimes, though, it was local police rather than DAs. And sometimes the actual form regarding the reporting was not in the child's file, but there were notes indicating referral to law enforcement.
When we looked at this matter and followed these so-called critical incidents and injuries through the process, there originally were a much larger number of cases that didn't get referred to DAs that seemed that they should have. We looked more deeply at it, not just relying on their computer system, and did find that some had followed not the appropriate channels, but they had somehow, through a phone call, through an email from a personal email, had been brought to the attention of the district attorneys. There were, however, bottom line, 19 cases that never went to DAs, and we know that because we took these 19 cases and brought them to DAs and said, do you know anything about these? And they said no.
Now, your report covers 2014 to 2015.
Right.
And it was in September of 2015, though, that Governor Baker instituted some major reforms at DCF because the agency has had huge problems. I mean, and he committed $100 million to DCF, hired more than 300 social workers, 96 managers. I mean, is it possible that if we looked at 2016 and 2017 records that many of the problems that you're identifying wouldn't be there?
It's highly doubtful because they haven't in the first instance of the serious bodily injuries that were treated and about which DCF knew nothing. The policy hasn't changed, so that they weren't then, and they still aren't using the MassHealth database to identify these medical treatments for serious injuries. So there's no reason to think that that has changed.
We just got a couple seconds. How easy would it be to make that change?
Pretty easy. It doesn't require another $100 million or another 200 social workers to do this. This is a change in policy requiring social workers to look at this medical history database.
Well, Suzanne Bump is the auditor for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We've got a link to more information about her report on the Department of Children and Families at our website, radioboston.org. Suzanne Bump, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Diane von Furstenberg. She's a fashion legend, the designer who created the iconic wrap dress. Maybe you've got one in your closet. By the way, the Smithsonian has one too. That's how important it is in the world of fashion. Interview magazine calls her America's fashion godmother, complete with an immigrant story. Diane von Furstenberg arrived, suitcase full of dress samples, in New York in the early 1970s, and just a handful of years later, she was on the cover of Newsweek magazine. The company that bears her name, DVF, is now a global luxury fashion brand. Von Furstenberg is also an outspoken and influential mentor. Today, she's in Boston, delivering a keynote address at the Massachusetts Conference for Women. We caught up with her just before she took the stage to speak to the conference's 10,000 attendees. Well, first of all, let me ask you, you are here at the conference at an extraordinary moment in history when issues important to women are being discussed unlike they've ever been discussed before. So what is your message for the women who are hearing you today?
Well, my message to women in general, my you know, how I use my voice to women is to really give them as much confidence as possible. And it's not like I have a recipe. It's the confidence and the strength is inside the woman. I just kind of unleash it. Because I have yet to meet a woman who is not strong. They don't exist. But sometimes a brother, a father, a husband, a religion, and very, very often ourselves, we don't want to show our strength because we want our men to feel big or whatever. And then we forget we are strong. And then all of a sudden a tragedy happened, and miraculously the strength comes out, and it's always the woman, you know, who takes over and who saves the situation. So it's always a good reminder that, you know, to know that you're strong before any tragedy happens. So that's one thing. But now, of course, you know, so it's about that. It's about all of that, mm-hmm. that I share my mother's experience, who was a survivor of the Holocaust. My mother was 13 months in a concentration camp in Auschwitz, mm-hmm. and she survived. And, of course, you know, she used to say, God saved my life so that I can give you life. And by giving you life, you gave me my life back, and you are my torch of freedom. So this, the torch of freedom, is what was put in my hands mm-hmm. when I was a child. So being independent was extremely important for me, and I became independent. And I became not only independent, but I became very successful. And all that through a little dress.
Right. And, so, Ms. von Furstenberg, may I interrupt just for a moment? Because I definitely want to ask you more about your mother in just a second. But I'm curious regarding sort of this issue of sexual.
No, I'm getting there.
No, but I was going to ask you about sexual harassment and whether or not at any time in your career you had encountered
something
like that.
Yes, I was getting there. Okay. So, because of the dress that happened at the time, it became very much the dress of the movement of liberation, women's liberation. It happened at the same time. And I was completely a feminist. I always was a feminist. But I have to say that I was brought up in another generation, and therefore I took it for granted and I accepted that being a woman, you got your period every month and you got groped all the time. That was just part of being a woman. And then you defend yourself however you can. And that was that. But now I realize that no, it shouldn't be like that. And I applaud the women who speak, because we should not be treated as meat. And you can flirt and you can seduce and you can do all of that, but you cannot abuse your power and assume that touching when not wanting to be touched is something you can do.
So that had happened to you. I mean, I take your point that at the time...
It has happened to every woman.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a woman that it hasn't happened to. But so much is buried in our memory. I didn't even remember. Recently, I remembered a lot of them that I didn't... I just took it for granted that this happened. But of course, I only had two bosses, and it was before I was 22. And after that, I didn't have a boss. I was my own boss.
Right.
So I wasn't in a situation that, you know, my boss abused his power and I was afraid I needed the job because I had children at home. I wasn't in that position. I did have, though, early in my career, a boss that came very, very strong on me, and I had to defend myself and so on. But eventually I turned him around and he did become a mentor, and he did become a very important mentor in my life. So, but those are things that women know how to do, but, you know, not always.
Yeah. You know, Ms. von Furstenberg, you are absolutely right to point out that you haven't had that many bosses because you've been extraordinarily successful in your career. I mean, you had children, married, moved to America, started your business, bought your apartment on Fifth Avenue, were on the cover of Newsweek all before you were 30 years old. I mean, when you look back at that time period, are you astonished by how much you accomplished?
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I feel so... I can relate so well with the millennials today, because I was what they want to be. So I was lucky. I was very lucky to do things very, very early. Because then you have room to make many mistakes after that, which clearly I made. And then you have the ups and downs about your life and the successes and the failures and the diseases and all of the things that happen in a lifetime. Mm. But my big advice always is you have to make sure to always remember that the most important thing in life is the relationship with yourself. Because if you have that, any relationship after that is a plus and not a minor and not a must. Because being needy is not attractive.
Right.
And then the other thing that I think is important to remember, and it's something that I preach, which doesn't mean, by the way, that I always practice, is that when you doubt your power, you give power to your doubts.
I see. You know, how much of this wisdom that you have has come from your mother and her experience and her strength? I was incredibly
so
moved.
Much.
Yeah, I was moved so, moved by hearing you tell us that she called you her torch of freedom. Tell us more about her.
And it's very funny because now at the end of my life, I just turned 70. I am the godmother of the Statue of Liberty because we're raising money to build a museum there. So it's funny that my mother said the torch of freedom, and now I'm taking care of Lady Liberty and her torch.
Yeah, I mean, your mother was. I was seeing that when she was liberated from Auschwitz, she was just 49 pounds. I mean, the horrors she must have experienced are unimaginable. It just tells more about her and her character and her spirit.
No, but the most incredible thing about that is she could not move. I mean, her weight was less than what her bones should be. And when she had to fill the paper to, you know, about her identity, so which I found later, it says her name, her last name, her first name, her address, and then it said state of health. And although she could not move and she weighed 49 pounds, she wrote excellent health.
Huh. Wow.
She refused to be a victim. She just always refused to be a victim. And that is why she survived.
And as you grew and your career flourished, was she able to witness much of that?
Oh, yes. She only died 16 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And what did she tell you about the difference you were making?
No, she was proud of me. My mother was a tiger mom. She was tough, you know. If I was afraid of the dark, she'd put me in the dark. She'd probably go to jail today. So, but she was proud of me, and we had a good relationship. But when you have a very, very strong mother, you kind of, you know, you push against it. It's only when they are gone that you let it go and you can show your total admiration. And that is absolutely normal. I mean, I have the same thing with my... I mean, I spent last night, one of my granddaughters at RISD here in Providence, so I had a sleepover with her last night, and I was telling her, oh, it's so much fun to be with my granddaughter because you're so much less strict than my daughter, you know, because... And she laughed. She said, you know, we are a family of generation after generation of women who give advice, and everybody takes, you know, their advice as such pearl of wisdom. But when it's your mother, it's annoying until your mother is no longer there, and then you get worse than she was.
Absolutely. You know, this is making so much sense now because I'm thinking of a line that I've heard you say before, that the kind of woman you design for, is independent, beautiful, and in charge of her life. Now, I think I'm in charge of her life.
Yes.
That's right. It seems so. Now it's making sense where this drive and this design sense comes from.
Yes. No, it's very much important to be in charge of your life. That nothing is more important than that.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah. Well, I just have one more question for you, because I'm constantly looking for inspiration from great, you know, leaders and pathbreakers such as yourself. So here you are at this stage in your career. What excites you now? What gives you joy now?
Well, the thing that how I would like to focus my next act and the winter of my life, the autumn and the winter of my life, is by using my voice. You see, when you have been successful, two things happen. Once, you are financially independent, and two, you have a voice. And when you have a voice, it's important. So what I want to do is I want to use my voice, my experience, my knowledge, my wisdom, and weave it into a fabric of support and sharing and compassion and, most of all, of impact.
Yeah. So I've just enough time to ask you one more question, and then I promise you I'll stop. Can you tell me the story about the dress? I mean, how did you come up with this idea? It is an icon of fashion now.
Oh, it's a long story. It started with the fabric and with the printing. And at first, it was a little wrap top, and then I turned it into a dress. But the wrap dress is really like a kimono. It's a dress that doesn't have a zipper or buttons.
Yeah.
It's a dress that crisscrossed. What was different about mine is it was made out of jersey fabric, and therefore it molded the body. And furthermore, it was printed. And my prints are always somewhat a little feline because of their movement. And so it made the woman feel, you know, dressed and proper, but at the same time very sensual. And one person once told me, what I love about your dresses is that you get the guys and the mothers don't mind.
Well, Diane von Furstenberg, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Diane von Furstenberg is founder of the DVF global luxury fashion brand. She's creator of the wrap dress and chair of the Council of Fashion Designers of America. She spoke with us today just before giving a keynote address at the Massachusetts Conference for Women. I'm hoping that along with listening to this show every day, you also listen to Modern Love, the podcast. It's from the fabulous folks here at WBUR and the New York Times, and I'm lucky enough to be your host on that project as well. So for the rest of this week, we're going to be sharing excerpts from the podcast with you, starting with a Modern Love essay written by Victor Lodato. Now, when Victor moved to Ashland, Oregon, he expected to spend his days writing alone in his sublet apartment. But when he met his new neighbor, he was drawn into a friendship that was as deep and abiding as a love story. Ali Fuzzle reads this story. He stars in the new movie Victoria and Abdul. He reads Victor Lodato's essay, When Your Greatest Romance is a Friendship.
Is this your grandson? People sometimes ask Austin when she's out with me. I love watching her vanity prick up, the way she tilts her small white head and brings out her southern accent to correct them. No, honey, he's my friend. At this point, folks usually smile tightly and turn away, perhaps worried there's more than friendship going on between the old lady and the younger man seated at the bar or strolling through the supermarket, giggling like teenagers. Why we're giggling? I couldn't tell you. Often our mirth seems fueled by some deep delight at being together. Friendship, like its flashier cousin, love, can be wildly chemical, and like love, it can happen in an instant. When I met Austin, I was not looking for a friend. I'd come alone to this small town to finish a book, so when a bony, blue-eyed stranger knocked on my door, introducing herself as the lady from across the way and wondering if I might like to come over and see her garden, maybe have a gin and tonic, I politely declined. Watching her walk away, though, in her velvet slip-ons and wrinkled blouse, I felt a strange pang. A slow pin of sadness that I suppose could best be described as loneliness. Suddenly I was dashing into the dirt road to say that I was sorry, that she had caught me in the middle of work, but that, yes, I would enjoy seeing her garden. Not the gin and tonic? Sure, that too, I answered, blushing. And before I could suggest a visit the next week, she said, so I'll see you in a few hours then. Shall we say 4:30? I had to admire her sense of time. Next week is for someone who can afford to put things off. Austin, in her 80s, surely felt no such luxury. I liked your face, she admitted later, telling me she had spotted me at the mailbox. As she poured the gin, I told her I had also seen her at the mailbox, and I liked her face too. I wish I had better eyebrows, she said. They used to be fabulous. Her garden was astounding, like something dreamed rather than planted. A Mad Hatter gothic in which a lawless grace prevailed. At dusk, the deer arrived, nibbling the crab apple blossoms. We had been talking for hours, slightly tipsy, and then we were in the kitchen cooking dinner. A retired psychologist, Austin had traveled extensively, spoke terrible Spanish and worse French, and was a painter now. She had had two husbands, the second of whom died in this house, in a small bed in the living room. "That's what I'll do," Austin told me. "This room gets the best light." We turned to the windows, but the light was already gone. That we could be quiet together so soon and without strain felt auspicious. "So you ran away from home," she said at one point. From the beginning, there was something about our interaction that reminded me of friendships from childhood, in which no question was off limits. Austin seemed afraid of nothing, least of all death. I said I was still afraid of the dark. "Living alone," she said, "can make you funny." I laughed, but changed the subject, telling her I would like to see her paintings. Later, crossing the road back to my sublet, I wondered what I was doing. I reminded myself of my plan, hiding out, staying in the dream of the book. I wasn't here to socialize. After years of work on a single project, I was in the final stretch. I could finish a draft in a few months, head back home. Besides, if I wanted a friend during my retreat, I would find someone my age to throw back beers with. Gin and tonics with an old lady in her garden, that wasn't in the plan. But there I was, the next weekend, having dinner with her. And then it was every weekend. Sometimes we went out to a restaurant or hiked in the mountains. Austin's older friends seemed confused. "Is he helping you with the computer?" one asked. When I first started talking about Austin to my own out-of-town friends, they assumed I'd found a new boyfriend. "Austin's a woman," I would say. "Besides, she's in her 80s. She's just a pal." Even as they replied, "That's cool," I could almost hear them thinking, "Must be slim pickings out there." What was confusing, I guess, was not that two people of such different ages had become friends, but that we had essentially become best friends. Others saw our devotion as either strange or quaint, like one of those unlikely animal friendships, a monkey and a pigeon, perhaps. If we made no sense from the outside, it didn't matter. We were mostly looking at each other. One night, Austin chatted about her life as a middle-aged wife in academia. "I completely missed out on the wildness of the 60s, she said. I told her I had missed out too. "You weren't born yet," she said. "Or hardly." Often we cooked together, as we had that first night, after which she would show me whatever painting she was working on. At her request, I also started reading to her from my book in progress. We gave each other feedback. Our work improved. When my 6-month lease was up, I renewed it. The novel wasn't finished. Plus, I couldn't imagine a better neighbor. Before I knew it, 3 years had passed. I was writing 7 days a week and spending most evenings with Austin. She had spells of vertigo now, and when we walked together, she held my arm. Often she couldn't find the right word for something. When she wanted to keep away visitors so she could paint, she hung a sign on her studio door: "Do not destroy." Soon the headaches came, and more jumbled language. "I need to screw my calls," she said, meaning she needed to screen them. We laughed, then sobered. Tests were scheduled. Now she's 8 months into what the doctor says a quick, ravaging illness deep in her brain. They say there is no stopping it. A year more if she's lucky. Even as I refuse to believe this, I prepare for it. How? By keeping my promise to her. A few months before her diagnosis, Austin had attended a wedding. She showed me a copy of the vows which had been distributed at the ceremony, a detailed list. I read it carefully at Austin's request. We were sitting in a car, waiting for our favorite Thai restaurant to open. I never had anything like that with the men in my life, she said, pointing to the vows. We loved each other, but we didn't have that. She was crying now, something she rarely did. I took a hand and said, well, you have it with me, everything but the sex. At which point, the monkey kissed the pigeon. That night, I had an odd realization. Some of the greatest romances of my life have been friendships. And these friendships have been, in many ways, more mysterious than erotic love. More subtle, less selfish, more attuned to kindness. Of course, Austin was going to die long before I did. That's not what this is about. This, I have come to understand, is a love story. Austin continued to paint for several months more. Fractured, psychedelic self-portraits in scorching colors. Her best work. Lately, though, she is tired and hardly leaves the couch. I sit with her at the opposite end, our legs intertwined. Read to me, she says. When I tell her the book is finished, she tells me to read her something new. But whenever I do, she promptly falls asleep. I don't leave, though. I stare out the window. Austin was right. This room does get the best light. Recently, her hair has thinned, but she has a shock of white up front that a friend's daughter has dyed with a streak of fuchsia. She looks like some punk girl I might have dated in high school. She had a bit more energy the last time I came to visit and said, oh, Victor, I had the most wonderful dessert yesterday. Peaches and Connecticut. Have you ever had it? No, I said, smiling. I love the idea of it. Two things that don't seem to go together. Monkeys and pigeons. Beaches in Connecticut? Unlikely, yes, but delicious beyond measure.
That's Ali Fuzzel reading Victor Lodato's essay, When Your Greatest Romance is a Friendship. Now, as part of Modern Love, the podcast, we oftentimes follow up with actors to see why they chose a particular essay to read for us. Here's what Ali told us.
This one line really sticks with me. It says, there were no questions that were off-limits. And it's that space of total nudity that I feel, once you cross that, the word intimacy just suddenly widens up. And it's huge because it's not about friendship. It's not about love. It's just something very spiritual. You could be kissing or you could be not kissing. You could be sleeping, you could be not sleeping. You could be just reading. You could just be talking. And I think that's just beautiful.
That's Ali Fuzzel. You can see him in the new film, Victoria and Abdul. Now, I really hope you liked what you heard here today, and that if you haven't already, you'll subscribe to the Modern Love podcast. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you want more information about Modern Love, go to wbur.org/modernlove. And make sure you've got Radio Boston's podcast while you're at it as well. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Zoe Mitchell and Cassandra Sunt. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.